morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to another installment of On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We come at you every Sunday morning, and then actually you can listen to it anyhow, anytime, because it stays there. Now, how about that, Rabbit?
Yeah, that's... Oh, we're having a different introduction today.
How exciting.
We're doing something different.
Well, we're changing seasons.
We're always trying to do something different. Yeah, the change of season is practically upon us.
Right.
It's unofficially fall.
Yeah, you know what I miss the most, though, are summer tomatoes.
Yeah, well, there's a few more hanging on the vine. Although they're a bit green, we might be having fried green tomatoes instead of salad tomatoes, but that'll be fun. And there are some peppers turning red.
Oh, that's good.
So maybe we have some hot peppers after all.
Good.
And there's a one of the pepper plants wants to be a tree.
Which is very encouraging. Tall.
They got kind of off to a slow start because they weren't in quite the right place in the garden, but they're doing okay now.
It was that hideous mint was.
Yeah, and the blackberries are done, and the raspberries are still producing. So the Haig farm continues to operate, but that, of course, isn't what you're interested in for today's program. So what's up on the agenda, sweetheart?
Well, we're going to start out with, such a fascinating couple, a husband and wife culinary team and their restaurant, which they actually literally built with their own hands in California.
It's a really fascinating story that I'm sure you're going
to
enjoy. And it's not entirely a coincidence that it's in Berkeley, California, where some people will suggest that Alice Waters started the American food revolution back in the 1960s. So here's a couple that's making some noise and a place we're sure going to be heading for next time we're in San Francisco. So All About Eve.
On the Menu gets some very interesting stories, and listeners, you're in luck because you're going to hear one of the most fascinating stories. It's a story of a husband and wife chef team, Christopher and Veronica Laramie. Welcome to the show, Chris and Veronica.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Your restaurant is called Eve, spelled lowercase e, capital V, lowercase e, and it's in Berkeley, California. But you've had some very circuitous backgrounds, traveling all over the place, starting with, here we go, Veronica, you were born in Peru.
I sure was, and I'm so proud of it.
I'm dying to go to Peru. It's one of the hot cuisines now, you know.
It is, and I'm so glad finally the world gets to see it, you know, and taste it.
And tell us, you come from different backgrounds, but you did meet in Paris?
We did. Actually, my husband Chris was born and raised in Colorado, and we both went to college. And then by the time we were 22 and 23, we both moved to Paris and ended up at the same school. We went to the Cordon Bleu for the year program. We did both cuisine and pastry, and long story short, we got married after 8 months of knowing each other.
Oh, that's okay. So there you were, and you got married. Did you get married in Paris?
No, we got married in Miami after we moved back.
Okay. So I guess that was a natural with Veronica's Spanish background, huh?
It sure was. I used to spend 2 or 3 months of my year in Florida. My parents had an apartment there, and I was feeling really comfortable. I had family there, so that was our first stop after France.
And you also spoke the language, right?
I did, yeah. I was not as fluent as I think, as I want to think that I am right now.
No, you were
a lot
better. I was joking. You were speaking the native language of Miami, which is Spanish.
Yeah, which is the northernmost city in Latin America.
Exactly. That's good.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Now, Chris, you are a savory chef, and Veronica, you are a pastry chef.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. We kind of divided like that.
Okay. Well, it's a natural, isn't it?
Yes, it turned out to be that way. It's a perfect combination.
Now, what are some, you've both worked in some very important restaurants. Could you just mention a few of them?
Sure. After Paris, I landed in Miami at the Bluto restaurant in the Delano Hotel, which at the time was fantastically hopping. Very big money spenders down there and very kind of hedonistic and sexy. It was a lot of fun. And then we were in Miami a couple years, and I got tired of the heat and hurricanes and went to Chicago, and I landed at Everest.
Oh, that's a good one.
Jean Joho.
Yeah, he's been on the program too.
Yeah, he's a fantastic chef. I learned the ins and outs of Alsatian food and how to cook cabbage a lot.
he was an amazing guy. His life story is really quite amazing.
Yeah, he's very accomplished.
And while you were there, Veronica was at Charlie Trotter's. Charlie is a very particular person, isn't he?
He is. I mean, I got the job just because I think he was meant to be. I came on the back door and knocked, and I said, I want to work here. And it happened that they were trying to reach me because I did send my resume, and for some reason they picked mine from, like, the thousands of ones that they get. And it was meant to be, and, yeah, he was a very special person, but I think I owe him most of the percentage of the chef that I am right now. And it was a fun time. I got to cook with the best chefs from all over the world and use the best products without having to worry about the budget. So it was unbelievable.
Now, the only people have to worry about the budget at Charlie Trotter's are the diners, I guess.
Yeah, I know. But at that time, I think it was there during his best years, and we were so busy all the time. The restaurant was doing great, so it was a great time for all of us, the cooks that were during that time there.
Now, there was a visiting chef that we talked about earlier on, Andoni Aduritz from Mugaritz, just outside San Sebastian, and you said you cooked with him and you really liked him a lot.
Oh, yeah. I met him in 2005, and since then we became friends, and we've done some things together. I helped him and just kind of like an assistant a little and a translator as well. And overall, he's a good friend and a really big inspiration for my cooking, and I wish I could go and spend some time in his kitchen and stash there.
Oh yeah, well,
we love him.
Well, you'd have a wonderful time, and if you go there, you must go to Arzak as well, because Elena.
Oh yeah, of course. Elena, it will be Arzak and Marguerite and Abui if we can afford them all at
right.
the same time.
Oh yeah.
Now something happened. Something you must have drunk in the water or something like that, and so you decided you'd do something completely crazy, like open a restaurant and do
right,
it in California,
in the middle of a recession.
And doing it kind of differently than anybody else would ever have thought of. So why don't you pick up the rest
and
of the story?
Did you pick up that? Christopher said, and of course, in the middle of a recession.
Oh yeah, we noticed that. I noticed that.
How bright is that, Christopher?
Well, a lot of people have said there's never a good time to open a restaurant, just because it's risky business in general. I happen to think that the best time to open a restaurant is in the middle of a recession, because all of the initial costs, equipment and rent and all of those things, are at a deep discount when no one else is buying. So we've pretty much got everything on sale. We picked a teeny little space. We have 700 square feet, which includes everything, the bathroom and the dish room.
Oh, wow.
The kitchen and the dining room. It has 28 seats. We built the whole thing ourselves. It used to be a nail salon. So even from putting the grease trap in to building some walls, putting the hood in, redoing the electricity, plumbing and whatnot, we did pretty much most of the manual labor except for electricity and plumbing.
So, and you even poured the concrete tables?
Yes, we did. We found the recession was kind of an inspiration for how to go about doing this restaurant kind of by hand, from scratch. And so we found that we could pour concrete tables cheaper than we could buy laminated, like, fiberboard, ugly tables that we'd eventually have to cover with tablecloths.
Uh-huh.
And then you take into the account the amount of money that you spend on tablecloths throughout the year, and it's astronomical. So now we have gorgeous poured concrete tables that is pretty much like what you'd find in a higher-end custom home that they use for countertops. We did them ourselves, and each one is different. They all look great.
Well, how long did all this take you?
We started, I guess, in mid-July of 2009, started with the city permits and all of that stuff, and opened in early December of 2009. So it didn't take that long.
That's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, it's not a huge space, so there was a lot of detail work, but it's not a massive scale.
But how did you learn all this? How did you know all this? It's a far cry from just the kitchen.
We watched YouTube videos for most of it.
Oh, my goodness.
No kidding.
You can find anything on YouTube.
Started kind of researching and learning building code and stuff like that. So you know, I knew to make walls that were 10 inches on center for the studs, and just went from there, and everything passed code.
There you go. But it was also about a concept for the food. You had an idea about what you wanted to do in a restaurant.
Yes, we did. I mean, actually, our like business plan was a concept and how we wanted this restaurant to be. It's been in the works since 2007. When we left Chicago and we wrote our business plan trying to find investors. So we really totally knew what we wanted to do, and it was going to be this intimate small spot. We just needed to find the right city and the right crowd that will support what we do. And we didn't care if we had to move all the way to China.
Right.
So fortunately enough, we found it here in California. And so the main concept for the whole place was handmade in small batches, in the whole sense of the world. So it's like the building of the restaurant plus the food as well.
Now, is this what you call neo-artisanal cuisine? I'm glad somebody came up with a new term for contemporary food.
It is. What we had seen is that we have a lot of friends that are in the business. They're all about our same age, and they're all kind of doing the same food. Molecular gastronomy has kind of gone by the wayside as being an ugly term people kind of associated with Frankenstein food and stuff like that. So people were doing modern food using those techniques, but not simply just for the show. But no one had a term for it, so we'd go to someone's restaurant and said, hey, we really like what you do. What do you call what you do? And everyone kind of paused, and it was kind of the $64,000 question. No one's come up with a name for it yet. So whether or not ours stick, we're kind of just throwing it out there. And so for us, New Artisanal, we define by hand-picking the best produce. We shop almost every day, and we make everything from scratch in small batches.
So you're using
kind of a modern twist.
So you're a farmer's market to table, bought locally, seasonally, all of that kind of stuff?
Exactly. The only thing that we have purveyors for is meat and fish. Otherwise, we shop every day for all of our produce and dairy.
Can you explain a little bit more by explaining perhaps a few dishes that are on the menu?
Well,
and,
sure.
And I mean, I know it varies from day to day because of what you can find.
Well, look at this corn soup on this menu that I have off the internet. It has red bell pepper, the wheat locoche, the fungus,
mm-hmm.
the shiitake mushrooms, and crawfish. Now, that's really fascinating. It's
sure,
not
so
even
it's
regional. I mean, it's not anything in particular to Berkeley.
No, except that corn season is really good out here right now. So it's a cold corn soup, pretty traditionally made with like a white mirepoix and the bell peppers blended and served cold. The wheat locoche, we're making a pudding with it, and that's served on the bottom of the plate. The bell pepper is served as a jelly, and then we're just using the crawfish tails, a little bit of fried shiitakes and scallions.
Right. And
oh, it sounds just so easy. I mean, I could rustle that up in a minute.
You're using sustainable fish like ling cod.
Right. And then also, yeah, you know, one of the things that, of course, Berkeley is, everyone wants to know, where is it from, what farm, you know, where are you getting your stuff? And sometimes we use local as much as we can, but sometimes there's better practices. For instance, we were getting bronzino from Greece earlier in the spring, but it was substantially like an open ocean farm.
Okay.
But it was even better than local. It was sustainable.
Well, you know, that whole thing, because somebody just wrote an article on the economics of sustainability and locavores and so forth. And, I mean, his argument was shot through with holes as far as I was concerned. You know, but I think that the whole issue is coming under review about how everything has to be absolutely local. Because it's a little silly. You're not going to get olive oil locally, are you? Well, California, you would.
Well, we're spoiled here in the Bay Area, and
yeah,
certainly not every restaurant.
You're not going to get coffee.
Right. I mean, if you were, say, at a restaurant in Cleveland, your local is not going to be that varied, and you're going to have short seasons on things because half the time it's winter there.
Right.
But you can take advantage of the beet season and the radish season, those seasons when they're in, correct?
Sure. Yes. We, you know, and most everything is grown out here, and actually we found that even doing supermarket and farmer's market shopping, most things are cheaper than I was paying for wholesale in other cities we've worked in, such as
Chicago and Denver.
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you have a dish that you that's like been new on the menu in the last couple of days that you could go through? I think it would be fun to sort of see your mind at work as you saw a particular ingredient in the market.
Sure. So I think the one that really showcases what I like to do is kind of take familiar flavors and just turn them on their head. So when melon season came up in August, I always thought about melon and prosciutto, which is classic Italian breakfast. And so what we did was I took the melon and made gazpacho with it, basically just substituting the melon for tomatoes. Pretty much everything else is the same. And then we serve it with some prosciutto rosette, a little bit of compressed melon balls, and a champagne gelée, and some grated almonds, and that's it. It's a cold soup also.
It sounds like your food's pretty also. I don't have any pictures of it, but it sounds pretty.
Yeah, actually, I have a picture of that one that I can send if you like.
Sure, that would be really neat. Now, where does the pastry chef come in here, Veronica? You're doing the same kind of, you have the same kind of approach, but pastry's a little different.
Hey, you're
yeah,
like this one.
It's a little different. You know, a lot of the stuff, like really modern chefs are doing, takes a lot more than one person and a lot more than the amount of hours that I have during the day. So sometimes I need to stay a little more simple than what I wish. Right now we don't have an ice cream machine, for example. And it's a little of a challenge for me to make ice creams, even though I love them. But so I just try to use, of course, seasonal fruits or vegetables because we incorporate either one and tons of spices and herbs. And we always have a cheese course, a fruit-based dessert, and a chocolate-based dessert. So we have a little of a variety for everyone.
Well, this is interesting here because we had such a slew of blackberries this year. I ran out of ideas of what to do with them. And you have a dessert on this summer menu that uses blackberries with molasses, cocoa nibs, and tamarind. Now, that's exciting.
Yeah, it's a very nice dish that actually stayed the whole summer. People love it because we have like three dishes in the menu that stay for the whole season, and that's one of them. So we made almost like a flourless cake, chocolate, very nice and soft with like 97% dark chocolate. And then I make like chocolate and molasses curd on the bottom, so that molasses flavor, like almost burnt caramel kind of thing that gives you, it's very nice and contrasting. And then we made a tamarind pudding, and the blackberries we cold smoke them with Lapsang Souchong tea, which is a kind of black tea from
China. Ooh, we could try that.
Yes.
They're still
so going away,
in,
actually. Tomorrow is the last day. I'm changing it for next week. I'm changing it and making a new chocolate dessert. I think it's great that we have seasonal stuff, but we as chefs get kind of sick of it.
You know what?
Too long for the same dish.
You're making us so hungry. We're gonna have to terminate this conversation pretty soon. We're getting to be so hungry. I think about the only thing left for us to say is, boy, we gotta find a good excuse to get to California and go north to Berkeley and sample it for ourselves.
We also need a web page.
So please give our listeners the parameters for how they'll find out more.
Well, sure. Our website is www.eve-berkeley, with three E's, BERKELEY.com. The menu on the website is always the menu that's in the restaurant that night. It's not a sample menu. Every time we change the menu, we update it online.
Oh, wow.
And they can find everything there, from little press snippets to reservations, how to get in touch with us, our bios and whatnot.
Now, how busy have you been?
Actually, we've been fantastically
busy. Fantastically busy, okay.
Yeah, you know, the great thing about a small restaurant is that it doesn't take a lot to fill it up.
Right. And you're open just for dinner, or are you open for lunch as well?
We're not open for lunch. It's dinner only.
Dinner only 6 nights a week?
5 nights a week, Tuesday through Saturday.
Well, you sound like a fun couple, and I can hardly wait. Next trip, West Coast, you're going to have guests.
Well, we'd be honored to have you anytime.
And we are so delighted to have had the chance to talk to you, place you on this new wave that's really sort of old-fashioned in a way, isn't it?
It is. I think we're a little bit of a mom-and-pop shop, but
doing things in a newer style.
Well, we wish you continued
lots of luck.
Yeah, we wish you continued success, and please say hello to all of our friends that you are in contact with over the internet. I'm sure you do that a lot.
Yes,
we will.
Okay, ciao.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye bye.
You know, sweetheart, it really makes my heart pump in the right way to hear about some nice young people doing such an exciting thing. Don't you think it makes you want to be young again almost?
I don't think I'd want to be that young again.
but whether opening the restaurant's the right way to make a fortune, I'm not sure. But
we need to take a break. But I'll.
Oh, we do. Okay.
I was going to announce that I see the pattern of these shows you assembled, but I'll hold that till we get back from the short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. So, okay, so what was the cliffhanger?
Well, no, I mean, it's very clear now to me. I mean, here we are, a loving couple, long-term loving couple, working together happily. We just did the interview with the Eve people, another happy, loving couple working together, and we're moving into, yet again, another loving couple, Shauna Ahern, with her husband, Danny Ahern, wrote The Gluten-Free Girl, that's Shauna, and The Chef, and that's Danny.
And it's a love story with recipes woven in between, and they tell a lot more about their life together than I think you and I might do on the air, but they decided to do it, put it in print, and it's really a wonderful story.
It's wonderful. I read Shauna James Ahern's book called The Gluten-Free Girl and The Chef with kind of mixed reactions. First of all, it was so romantic, it sort of sweeps you off your feet if you are born a romantic, which I am. And on the other hand, it's a cookbook. So I was fascinated with the recipes, which are unusual and really interesting. And also with your husband, Danny, who is a chef's little side instructions on how to do things.
Why don't we say welcome to the program?
Oh, well, I will. Shauna, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, you seem like you're in a very good place in your life. And I follow you on Twitter, and so I know that a lot of people are congratulating you, not just on your book, but on your happiness that you found.
It's a beautiful thing. You know, we're very, very lucky. And it has always been my greatest joy to be able to write. And Danny's has been his greatest joy is to cook for people. So the fact that we found a way to do this and work as a team is it's hard to beat.
And dancing together in the kitchen.
Absolutely.
and lots of other places, too.
And yes. Lots of other places. And now we have a two-year-old who dances on our feet as we dance.
So, yeah, no, there's not as much about, of course, I know a lot more about Lou because of your tweets. Mm. But you didn't have a whole bunch in the book, but I guess that's because of the timing.
Yeah, you know, the book is really, it's a way of sort of, for us, of looking at our lives right before she arrived. It's a record of a time from the time we met and fell in love through the time that Danny left the restaurant in Seattle where he was working, the restaurant that we write about all through the book. And unintentionally, I keep writing books that are little payants to times past.
Now, explain the organization of this book. It's not your usual seasonal organization of recipes.
That's right. It's a narrative cookbook, so it really is meant to be read cover to cover. We'll see how many people do that.
Well, I did.
thank you. And it's divided into two sections. So the first is called At Home, and it's really an introduction to us. We're not trying to say to everybody, oh, gosh, look at us, we're so great. But more, it's just a record of how we met, how we fell in love, how we wooed each other, and how we became then a working regular couple, all through food. I think food is a great central place, but it's also a great organizer for our lives. And so that's just kind of our personal story. And
well, this is, look at this movie, Eat, Pray, Love, you know?
That's right.
It's like everywhere, it's all associated with love and food and, you know.
But it's not gluten-free, it's brain cell free.
Yes.
Well, I know that she eats pizza in Napoli, so I can't have that. But
that amazed me. Why are there so many people with celiac disease in Italy?
It's actually celiac is quite prevalent through the world, and there are places in the world where it's more so, and it's places where originally they did not live on wheat. And when wheat and other gluten grains were introduced, you know, our ancient bodies reacted to it. And so the way that we survived was by developing celiac and saying, don't eat that stuff anymore.
And that applied in Italy? I mean, I thought they'd been eating wheat grain since Adam was a kid.
Yeah, that's southern Italy. But if you think about northern Italy, they're much more about risotto and other grains.
Okay.
Yeah, so it depends on what part of the country they run. And in Italy, it's actually quite astonishing. They took the tack I wish we could take here, which is to say, if we've got this many people with celiac, instead of doubting them or thinking that they're on a diet, let's embrace it. Let's make the best gluten-free food we can. And, of course, it's fantastic.
Now, let's put things in order. You were finally diagnosed with celiac disease in, I think, 2005, you said?
That's right, May of 2005.
Now, was the arrival of Danny before that or after that?
He was after that. I felt well for the first time in my life. And I had been struggling. The irony is, when I thought I could eat everything, I had about the same 8 to 10 meals every other week, which is what most Americans do. And I didn't have the energy to cook or to invent. So when I finally was diagnosed, I thought, no dating. Not going to date anyone. This is a self I've never been before. So I want to spend some time with myself. And I met him almost a year to the day after I'd been diagnosed.
Okay.
I said when we were chatting that we've been dying for and waiting for, because let's lay it out, that it's probably the fastest growing market in the specialty food business today,
right,
is gluten-free, which means either they're diagnosing it more readily or there are more people with it. I'm not sure which. But we've been waiting for somebody who has the graceful expression that you have and some animation, which you have, which a lot of these gluten-free books do not have, to explain as concisely as possible to our listeners what exactly is this.
So celiac is an autoimmune disorder, and my body, having it, reacts like gluten is a toxin, sends out antibodies to destroy it, and ends up destroying, the small intestine, and therefore I can't absorb most everything unless I'm gluten-free.
Now, gluten, let's make sure everybody understands. Gluten is the germ part of wheat.
That's right. It's the elastic protein that's in wheat, rye, triticale, spelt, camote, farro, and emmer.
Oh, all of those.
Okay.
All of those. Any of those ancient wheat forms of grains.
What about freca?
I think that's gluten, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'd have to.
They advertise that it's suitable for people with glucose intolerance. It's green. I think it is.
Yeah, it's picked.
Wheat.
The grain is picked green.
And roasted.
And then it's roasted.
Yes, if it has anything to do with wheat, it's not good for me.
Okay, well, then
oftentimes people will say to me, like, oh, this is low in gluten, and then, oh, I can't have a speck of it. Even half a teaspoon is enough to make me sick for 3 days.
Okay, so low in gluten doesn't get it. It's got to be zero.
Zero gluten, exactly.
But the wonderful part about it, and you discovered this right at the beginning of your adventures with Danny, I guess, when you decide to go to Italy, and everybody associates Italy with pasta, and not only that, but pasta made from durum wheat,
right,
grown in Abruzzo and the Marche mostly. So the most revealing thing, early in the book, I noticed you have a pasta recipe in there, and that's a gluten-free pasta.
It is. We worked on it for a couple of years. We so enjoyed our experience in Italy, and I was served fresh gluten-free pasta in a number of restaurants. And I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it.
Now, can you also buy dry pasta that's gluten-free as well?
Oh, absolutely. It's pretty ubiquitous now. There are some that are pretty poor, and then there are some that are great. There's one from Italy, a company named Bio Nature, which is fantastic, and we do that all, we buy that all the time.
We know then about gluten, what you have to do. It sounds like it's worse than lactose intolerance, actually.
It is. It's much harder. Danny is actually lactose intolerant, and he can sort of slip once in a while and have some milk and forget about,
Yeah, there's a pill they take, too.
That's right. But for me, it's really serious. And it's actually serious for a number of Americans, many more than was first believed. Celiac is actually the most underdiagnosed disease in the U.S.
So it's not on the rise. You think it's on the increase or just that it's getting to be more accurate to diagnose?
I think it's getting more accurate to diagnose. It used to be that it took an average of 11 years from the time you first started getting sick until a doctor would diagnose you.
Oh, wow. So it's just, it was just not really something that was well known in the medical profession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the actually what happened was there were doctors from all around the world who are celiac specialists here in the United States, and they petitioned the National Institutes of Health and said, look, if it's pretty ubiquitous all over the United, the world, why not here? It's about 1 in 200 generally. People in the United, like Italy or Germany or Australia, have it. Why would it be 1 in 5,000 the way it was taught in the U.S.? So they were given permission to test the blood supply, and that's when they found out that it was actually 1 in 133 people that have it in America.
Okay, so that's how you find it. You actually find it with a blood test?
You find it with a blood test.
Okay.
It measures antibodies in your body.
Okay, now let's go back to this extraordinary book.
Thank you.
This combination of
food. You know, I mean,
life story, love story, and recipes
that I'd make, and I can eat anything, you know.
Yeah, they're fabulous
so
recipes.
Bad.
What I was trying to figure out.
See, Peter's already, we have a rabbit in our freezer.
I have it.
I
have it noted already, but is there a sequence of events through the recipes? If there was, I couldn't figure it out.
Mm. A sequence of events?
No, are the recipes in a sort of a food-related order, or
yes.
do they continue to be in a life story-related sequence?
So we talked a little bit about the first section is called At Home, and that's our story, but the bulk of the book is At the Restaurant, and what that is 24 hours in the day of the life of the chef.
Okay.
So it starts with waking up hungry and ends with meals at midnight, and it's everything in between that Danny and then I helping him has to do to get food on the plate for the customers.
Yeah, I like the idea that he wakes up in the middle of the night, thinks of something, and writes it down on a piece of paper.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of chefs. Tony Pies used to
do
that, too.
Well, he does that, and he's trying to figure out what to do with the leftover Brussels sprouts from yesterday.
Yeah.
And trying to solve that, but you both love going to farmers' markets. Something, incidentally, that we adore to do, even though we don't buy anything, because
we
think they're just such special places.
I wish that we could say we didn't buy anything. We spend a lot of money at farmers markets, but it's a good money to spend. Yeah, you know, the thing that really is sort of the organizing principle for the book, besides us and loving food and falling in love with food, is that when you find you have to be gluten-free, the most important thing you can do is to eat well. I mean, if I'm going to have some kind of diagnosis, give me the one where I have to eat really great food to heal myself.
That's not such a bad idea, right?
You know, if somebody told me, okay, in order to be well, you have to eat chocolate mousse with strawberry jam and creme fraiche. Okay.
You can handle that, huh?
I can handle that. So really, the book is about falling in love with food and discovering food in a way, and that's why we really intend it for anyone, not just for folks who are gluten-free. We think of it as a great, well, hopefully a great book. We think of it as a book we love with food we love that happens to be gluten-free food.
Now, can you pick out two or three of your absolute favorites in the book?
That's hard.
I know. Well, you can take a second.
The first one that rises to mind, we try to have a balance of, you know, recipes that are fairly basic and you can make in a weeknight, and recipes that are also what our editor kept calling chefy. You know, Danny is a very talented chef. So the first one that rises to mind is his crisp pork belly with wild rice and dried sour cherries and a honey sage gastric.
Okay,
that sounds pretty good.
It's darn good. And then also, quite playful, but a friend of ours introduced us to it. We have potlucks all the time where we have ingredient potlucks. Everybody brings something with apples in them, and it's amazing to see what people come up with. And one of our potlucks was a bacon potluck.
Bacon, which is a big trend now.
It was quite fun. We felt a little bit sick at the end, but it was great.
Yeah, and do you know the bacon freak guy?
I do know a bacon freak. I know of him.
Rucker. Well, he would love that section. Now, as it turns out, I've selected a recipe because we have the main ingredient for it in the refrigerator. Mm. I mean, in the freezer downstairs, and it's the rabbit with balsamic sauce. Talk to us a little bit about that. Because you say some fairly controversial things about rabbit. Say we're not, the recipe doesn't do it this way. It does it this way because.
I can't remember what controversial things I said.
Oh, dear.
Well, I know that the recipe is, the recipes are Danny's. They're time-tested, and he's served them at restaurants, you know, throughout his career. That one, he worked at a very popular French bistro in Seattle named Cassis. It closed several years ago now. And what they would do is every night of the week, they had a French bistro favorite. So there was cassoulet, and there was this braised balsamic rabbit that he adored making, and we adore eating.
Okay,
we're going to
try that now. Now the balsamic vinegar it calls for, it doesn't have to be like 10 or 15 or 25 year old.
Oh, right, Yes, this is the kind of thing that we put through the books, the little techniques that Danny taught me that I didn't know. When I first met him, I thought, well, we should use really expensive olive oil for everything, including sauteing. And he's like, no. So when you are doing something like this, you can get a fairly inexpensive, you know, decent balsamic, but you can get it at Trader Joe's.
Yeah, I mean, you don't want the real old stuff because it's too sweet.
That would be a terrible waste, too.
Yeah, that's, but it's also not, it would be too sweet, I would think. I only use that for dessert. An ice cream, you know, with warm figs. Try that one.
Yeah, that's true. We actually got a nice bottle when we were in Italy, and it lasted for a long time because we found we couldn't use it on most
exactly.
things. Exactly. That's right.
Where is Danny now is working? He said he quit this restaurant.
Right. He quit the restaurant in Seattle, and he took a year off from being a chef after our daughter was born and to work on the book. And now he's working at a lovely place here on Vashon Island where we live.
Which is great.
And it's called the Hardware Store Restaurant, and I always have to add the restaurant because people feel sorry for him and say, oh, he has to work at a hardware store.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're going to make a trip to Seattle. We just promised to go to Maine, and we just did that trip, and we also promised to go to Vermont, so we'll do that, but we also haven't been to Seattle in a long time, and I hope so many of my buddies lived there, like John Rowley and, you know, all those people.
And Thierry.
John's a very good friend of ours, too.
Thierry
Ratchford. I love Thierry.
Isn't he a character?
He's a funny guy. You know what? We were having lunch at Le Bernardin in New York a few months ago, and I recognized Thierry from the back. He has some very nice clothes, but somehow he doesn't quite put them together.
Well, you know, if you're a character like that and you're distinctive enough, you can dress however you want.
There's no question that he does that.
Well, you haven't told us. I mean, I have a question about Lou.
Yes.
I read, what was the name of that book? Was it Mad Monkey? No, Hungry Monkey. Have you read Hungry Monkey?
Yes.
Is that not hysterical?
Well, that's actually another one of our dear friends.
Oh, really?
Matthew, who wrote that book. You know, that's been one of the gifts for me. And when I first started this journey, I was a full-time high school teacher. And I have found that, as I find talking to you, people who are involved in food are just really great people. Interesting, funny, generous. And so we, Danny and I, both are lucky to have a lot of really lovely people around us who happen to write about food.
Is she going through, because we have a granddaughter going through that phase, too. I mean, the granddaughter's 3 and a half, and, you know, every week, that it's a different issue.
No,
you
didn't note here for the people listening who haven't read the book yet that Lou is their child.
Yeah, Lucy, we all call her Lou everywhere, but her full name is Lucy, and she is just over 2 and delightful. And you know, she's not gone through a picky phase yet. We are waiting for it because I'm sure it will happen at some point. But she just loves food.
You're lucky. Yeah, we have one that loves it and one that's very picky, so you can get either one.
Well, I think some part of it's genetic. They're born that way, so we got lucky. But we also involve her in every step. She stands with us in the kitchen on her chair while we cook everything. And we, you know, she sometimes, like, will drag the chair over at 7:30 in the morning. I'm like, I don't really want to make a pie right now, but okay. You know, we've been putting whatever we cook. In fact, when we were testing the cookbook in particular.
You put it in the, what, Cuisinart?
No, we would put it under her nose. We would have her smell whatever we would cook. So we've been introducing her to food ever since. We'll see. Maybe at 3 she'll just decide she wants white bread, and we'll have to go through that.
Yeah, poor Ruth Rachel's son never ate anything but white food for years.
Wow.
Yeah. But, okay, you need to give us your website.
Yes.
Your blog address.
So the website is called Gluten Free Girl and the Chef. And the website address is glutenfreegirl.com.
Okay, very good. And I think that everybody will really enjoy this because there's so much humanity in your posts. One more question here before we wrap this up. This sounds almost too good to be true.
You mean our lives? Oh, wow, if you could see the state of our house right now, it's a mess. You know, I get that a lot because people will say, oh, you know, you're so happy, but it's a choice we've made. The choice to live a life of food, but we drive 20-year-old cars, we get all of our clothes from thrift stores, that the dishes always need to be done. So it's just a matter of what we put as a priority in our lives.
I see. Okay.
And we feel really lucky.
Well, it sounds it, and it's a delightful book, and congratulations to you on everything, your book, your life, your blog.
Thank you very much. It's really delightful to talk to you. And when you come to Seattle, please come over to the restaurant. We'd love to feed you.
I will.
Oh, good. And bring John. He's lovely.
Okay. Thanks, Shauna.
Thank you, Anne.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we need to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and here we are with another heartwarming story of a loving couple on a project seen realized.
A combination of anthropology,
photography,
and
writing,
and a fascinating food story for the ages, really, because it looks at people eating around the world, all the way from a Maasai lady in Africa to the top of the pops in terms of calories consumed, which sadly I have to report is a person from my native land who's eating far more than she should. But a fascinating story that they tell, and a fascinating book that you might want to get your hands on.
We seem to be running into some really massive projects with these books. Peter Menzel and, or is it Menzel? Menzel and Faith Alusio. Peter, you're the photographer and a writer as well. And Faith, you do the planning of the project.
I'm the writer.
Well, this is a 3-year project that I'm looking at. The title of the book resulting from the project, which took, as I understand it, 3 years, is What I Eat, Around the World in 80 Diets. And the book is so heavy that I have it resting on the chair arm because it was making my thigh numb.
We're sorry about that.
But you have a history of doing these massive projects. Hungry Planet was the last one. I don't know why we didn't interview after that one. Marion Nestle is nothing but, if not raving, over the quality of this book. And Mark Bittman, too. Right? Is it Mark Bittman, or was that the last interview here? Yeah, he's here, too.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and he says it's visually stunning, which it is, and it's truly unique in content, which, again, it is, and a mind-boggling feast of diversity and a fantastic accomplishment, and I agree with all those statements. Welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us how you set up this project. I mean, what you did was you essentially traveled around the world collecting diets. Explain to our readers how it's organized.
Well, what we did is chose about 30 countries and a dozen U.S. states to visit and to find interesting people, photograph after they revealed to Faith what their day's typical diet would be. And usually that diet was something that they had earlier in the week. We then set up a photograph of all the food that they would have eaten or they did eat in one day and made a nice portrait either inside their kitchen or,
outside
in their mud hut or, on an ice floe in Greenland or, a floating house on the Amazon River. And we photographed these people with that week's worth of food.
Days worth of food.
Then Faith weighed every tiny little scrap of food in the picture, and we categorized it and came home with that list. And then Faith and a group of experts analyzed what was in the food calorically, and then fact-checked, came up with a caloric total and a list of all the food that a person ate.
Including cigarettes or sodas.
Yeah, we also measured the person's age, weight, and height is also in the book, so that we have a face and a body.
Do you have any caloric output registered?
Do we what?
We know what calories they ingested, and it seems to me that some of them, you could tell that the harder workers or the bigger movers could produce or consume more calories and still stay slim. Mm-hmm. But you didn't measure actually what they did, but you did.
Well, it's when you think about it, it actually would be very easy, sort of in a vacuum, to figure out a metric for analyzing output. So physical output, versus the number of calories in, and so you know, are they using what they're putting in? Are they, is any of it converting to fat? All of those are interesting questions, but there, it really is no way to evaluate that across cultures.
You can look at the photos, though, and those are pretty amazing.
Exactly. And that really was what we had decided, and I write about that in the introduction. I do a pretty large paragraph on why we decided not to do that.
Okay.
And that was quite literally because when you start looking from culture to culture, society to society, and look at what people are doing for a living, there really is no metric for deciding, okay, so there's this amount of output, you know, physically, and it's to, you know, this many calories are being converted into, you know, their energy is going to energy rather than to fat, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Now, one of the things you can be pretty sure of is that the grand champion, the consumer of the most calories, who happens to be, sadly, from my native land, a reflection of the fact that, in fact, the English as a whole are getting really appallingly fat, just like Americans are. But at 12,000 and some calories a day, I guess it's not hard to figure out that perhaps she might be gaining a little weight.
The snacker mom.
Sure. And at the time, Jill was gaining weight, but this was actually, and this is true of a number of the people, this was, you know, obviously these are all anecdotal, which means that it's not a caloric average that we're looking at. So I write also about this in the introduction. The fact is that on some days she would be eating much less. On other days she might actually be eating more. Most people don't really know what they eat in terms of calories. They just eat either until full or they eat. There's a lot of reasons why people eat. What Jill's deal was is that she was a binge eater, and so we actually decided to encapsulate the number of calories that she would eat on a day that she was binging. And so we looked at, several days past and what her norm was to determine what exactly we would put in the picture. And that's actually how we ended up with this binging day. If you compare her, for example, to Rick Baumgartner of Tennessee, who is awaiting gastric surgery.
All right, he's the one who's on an 1,800 calorie a day diet.
He's on a strict low number of calories.
1,600, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In a year and a half, he lost 100 pounds, and he's just about to go into surgery next month after going from 500 pounds down to 400.
But his caloric intake would probably rival, in fact, maybe even be more than Jill's at times back to past.
Oh, sure.
Well, yeah, I guess you don't get to be 500 pounds or whatever he was without trying really hard.
Yeah.
No. He ate a lot of fast food, and he admitted to us that he would sometimes sit and eat an entire jar of mayonnaise and a package of saltines.
Oh, wow.
There you go. Do they go together? I didn't realize that.
Everything goes with mayonnaise, sure. If you live in Tennessee. Well,
tell me this. Were any of these people surprises to you? You already knew before you talked to them.
Were any of the individuals surprises?
Yeah.
No, I think everyone is a surprise to me, only because, not necessarily what it is that they're eating, but it's surprising to me how open everybody is. And
that was my next question.
Yeah, and
did
how,
they resent
and really
you?
How honest one of these people had to share their lives in a way that was, you know, pretty intrusive. So what we do is we share ourselves as well in the back of the book.
I was just going to say that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you're a brave couple here, but at the same time, you only eat 1,500 calories a day, Faith.
You know, but that's while I was writing the book.
I wasn't
doing any physical exercise other than tapping my fingers on a keyboard. And, I mean, if they could have measured my brain output, you know, energy-wise, probably I was burning a lot that way. However, I was very, very conscious of not overeating during the time I was writing because I wasn't getting any physical exercise. And quite frankly, I would not have really thought about it in the past had I not done this book and also Hungry Planet back in 2005. Because what we really started doing was sort of self-analyze. Because before we could go out and ask people to start measuring their own food, we really had to understand what exactly that meant. So we quite literally started measuring everything we ate for a while before we went out on the road, and then when we sat down to write the book as well, so that we could understand. The fact is that a tablespoon of vegetable oil, for example, is anywhere from 116 to 120 calories. Well, that's a lot of calories, and that's a lot of hidden calories, especially when you think about the fact that, you know, on average, the USDA says that, that we should be eating about 2,000 calories a day. well, a lot of these people in the book are eating more. Mm-hmm. There are some who are eating less. And most of these people don't know that how easy it is to add 120 calories just because you've put a little more oil in your food.
Tell my husband that one.
If you understand fried food, too, and how much oil that really contains, then you can understand why the calories are so high for fried food and why a diet of fried food will turn you into something that is very large.
Now, one of the points that you have interspersed with these studies, or case studies, or however we want to describe these, various essays about food politics and the leaders of the whole, what do we call it? I mean, it's food politics, right? Or
well, just people, knowledgeable people from different walks of life who can weigh in on certain subjects.
Yeah, tell our listeners some of the essays.
Well, we had Ellen Ruppel Schell, who's a journalist. She wrote about food taboos. Starts out talking about how, you know, when she first ate horse. And then she quite literally goes into a lot of specific examples about why we have the taboos we do.
Mm-hmm. Dog is another one, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, right, well, and Peter has always loved the writing of Wendell Berry. And
me too.
He's wonderful, you know, and so he basically has always sort of characterized, you know, himself as a Kentucky farmer, and he is, but he's also the author of, you know, 50 books of essays, you know, fiction and poetry. And so this particular piece that he did was excerpted from The Pleasures of Eating, which originally appeared in the book What Are People For? And it's just quite good, you know, just talking about, people have to actually buy the book to know exactly what he's talking about, but it's just, you know, it's just simple pleasures, you know, and how eating is changing. And way back when he first did this 20 years ago, eating was changing, and it certainly has changed a lot. I think a lot of us now in the United States and in the developed world, and really in the developing world as well, it's becoming an issue of really thinking about where our food comes from and why we eat the way that we eat, and maybe there are some changes we have to make.
Now, tell me this. You said that a lot of these people mentioned that the point of this book is to show the great diversity of food cultures as well as the similarities. Could you recount some of what you discovered as one or the other or both of those?
Well, you know, all of our books are really all about comparison and contrast, and also comparing oneself as a reader to the people that we cover. And so what we'd really rather have is for people to embrace the book in that way and find and their own discoveries. My personal discoveries are I can't look at any one of these pictures without thinking about some other picture that is either similar or completely dissimilar. You know, Nuko Saruni sitting there with her in drought conditions in Kenya. She's a Maasai herder. She's sitting there with quite literally the tiniest little bit of milk that she's been able to eke out of her drought-ridden cows. And, you know, most of the milk for the day has to be given to the herder, and she's not getting that much, but that and her cornmeal constitutes her day's worth of food plus a piece of fruit that her husband brought for her. But then when you listen to the story or read the story, you know, you get even, a better sense of who she is contextually. And then you compare her.
Yeah, you compare her to just any of the other 79 people in the book, and you really start to understand why the catastrophic American diet is failing. We need to look at what other people in other countries do. There's the good, the bad, and the ugly, and understand ourselves a little bit better.
So that was really the conclusion you reached to the book. It said there's information that people ought to get because they need to understand it if they're going to make intelligent choices.
Yeah, I think so.
That's Peter's perspective on it. I think it's anyone's perspective would be, you know, you always want to make intelligent choices, but what's all the information that you can gather in order to do that, you know? And one way that we try to do it is for other people is to show them how the world is eating. But that said, we really want people to sort of embrace the work, figure this sort of thing out for themselves. It's really easy to preach to the choir.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a lot of your listeners already know a lot of the things that we're saying. What's really interesting is that, you know, with Peter's beautiful photography, we put those sorts of things into context, but we put those sort of things into, you know, the cold light of day and let people really see for themselves how the world is eating.
How do you expect people will read this book, cover to cover? Or?
No. I wish they would, because I have a lovely introduction. I tend to wish that they would, but the beauty, I think, of the way that we put the books together is really you can approach it any way you like. If you want, you can flip through the pictures first, or, you know, you can go cover to cover. You can just open it anywhere and sort of start your exploration.
Yeah, it's so nutrient-dense that if you consume this in one day or try to digest it in one day, you would fail, and you probably should go ask for your money.
That's true.
Yeah, the other thing you should do is you should carry it in your hands and run up and down steps.
There you go.
Holding it, and you'll
be... You are so right. It is really... When it first came in from the printer, I told Peter, I said, I had no idea it was going to be this heavy and this big.
Yeah,
we should have maybe done 50 people.
The only guy who does books bigger than this is John False.
Yes, yeah. You
should try that. His latest one weighs in at about 7 pounds, I think. But you're well on the way, so it's an excellent exercise tool. Thomas Keller's latest book, which is also very large, we said was appropriate for making brick chicken. so we'll find a recipe which matches this one. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us on the menu. And Faith, we know that you're dealing with a personal health issue. We hope you get over it very soon.
Thanks. It's only a broken leg. It'll heal.
Yeah, there
thank
you go.
You.
Well, that just about wraps another. Does anybody want to know why I love my job?
Yes, I'm sure they do. I do.
I love my job because we get to meet and talk to so many interesting people. And, of course, it's centered around food, wine, and travel, but it's the personalities we encounter, the projects. Very interesting. I'm a people-centered person.
Yeah, and I like it because I get to work with the one I love. Isn't
Aww.
That fascinating? So let's not get too soppy. Let's
no.
just say... that we'll look forward to your joining us same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.